This podcast of Left, Right, and Center is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's go!
Israel's Gaza pullout, Iraq's missed deadline, plus all Sheehan all the time. Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, columnist for Fortune magazine and senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, holding down the center here on Left, Right, and Center. Joining me on the left side of the political spectrum from San Francisco today is Robert Scheer, a syndicated columnist based at the LA Times. On the right from Washington, as always, is Tony Blankley, columnist and editorial page editor at the Washington Times. And here with me in the Santa Monica headquarters and in the fourth dimension of political time and space is our own Arianna Huffington, editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post. Welcome all from across the country and across the political spectrum. Dramatic scenes in the Mideast this week. Let's talk about Israel first, as the pullout from Gaza stirred lots of emotions on all sides. This long-awaited effort, which had been planned controversially by Ariel Sharon, led to dramatic pictures of Israeli soldiers and police folks taking people forcibly from their homes, reports of both glee and yet sympathy from the Palestinian side. Bob, you've watched these things for a long time. What did you make of what's going on? What's its significance, and where is it going to go from here?
Well, I'm enormously impressed with the leadership that Ariel Sharon has shown and that the PLO is following in kind. This has been four decades in coming. I happened to have got into the Gaza Strip at the time of just after the Six-Day War, and I had been in Egypt, and then I went over to Israel. And for the life of me, I couldn't understand why Israel would want to keep the Gaza Strip. I thought they shouldn't keep the West Bank, that it would not make them more secure. It's taken almost four decades to figure this out. But as with Nixon's opening to China, it took Ariel Sharon, it took someone with his credentials to say the settlers are not making us more secure. And basically, sure, there's a lot of unanswered questions. What's going to happen to the West Bank? What's going to happen to Jerusalem? Will more fanatic elements be able to mess this up, both Jewish and Muslim? But I think it's a repudiation of religious fanaticism and biblical commandments to hold territory, and it's giving peace a chance in a very dramatic way, and that's great news for the world.
Sharon, even, Tony, I want to get you into this. I was struck when Sharon even used the phrase when there was one incident, I guess, that got reported where an Israeli settler grabbed the pistol, I guess, from a soldier and shot some Arabs, and you know, obviously putting at risk the whole thing. And Sharon called it Israeli terror as a way of really, you know, discrediting. And Tony, what is Nixon to China an immutable principle of history? Is that one of the lessons here?
Well, I wrote a year and a half ago when they announced the policy that it struck me that this was fundamentally the judgment of a seasoned old general trying to tighten to more defensible lines. Get rid of salients he couldn't easily defend in Gaza and the outlying areas of the West Bank. I never saw this, although I hoped it would be, I never saw it as likely to lead to peace, but it did look like it was going to lead to something like a Fortress Israel. Now, that could be sustained pending the time when there would be Palestinian negotiators capable of negotiating a peace. Now, Netanyahu quit the cabinet over this. He believes that this will be a base of rocket and other attacks on Israel. If Netanyahu is right, then Sharon was wrong to do this. On the other hand, the fence along the Gaza Strip seems to have pretty effectively kept out terrorists, and presumably Israeli defense forces can suppress rocket attacks from across the border. So it makes sense to me, but we'll have to wait and see.
Ariana?
Well, I think it is an incredible example of leadership and what leadership can do, and not just on behalf of Sharon, but also on behalf of his deputy prime minister, Ehud Olmert, who is an incredibly impressive man and who is positioning himself now to run against Netanyahu after Sharon steps down. And I met with him recently in New York, and I can't tell you how impressive it was to hear a man who was absolutely determined, no matter what happens in Gaza, to stay the course, to use that much abused phrase, and no matter how much resistance they encountered, that they were determined to create this new consensus around what was needed to move to the next stage of peace in the area. And that contrasted with Netanyahu's position, which is so clearly driven by his motives of creating a base for himself beyond what Sharon and Olmert are doing in his party, is so stark. It's, once again, there's nothing like one leader.
And Ehud Olmert was former mayor of Jerusalem, wasn't he? Because
yes.
I met with him, this is about 10 years ago, and there is something about Israeli, and maybe it's Middle Eastern politicians generally, and I don't have broad experience with them, but there is something about the seriousness and the life and death issues they deal with every day that gives them this, even when they're playing political games, which politics has, there's a weightiness to them, I find, that sometimes feels just light when you're here. Bob,
we're talking.
Let me say, Matt. This is Bob. I'm startled by
welcome, Bob.
I'm startled by what you just said. Are you saying when you worked in the Clinton administration that Clinton was not dealing with life and death issues, that George W. Bush is not dealing with life and death issues, or is it that we've made this into a kind of game with our news coverage and how we treat these issues, and because we don't have any kind of serious parliamentary politics and ideological base, that it becomes this great parlor game, and the fact that Americans are and Iraqis are dying every day is somehow rubs off George W. Bush in a way that it can't rub off an Israeli politician.
Yeah, it was an imperfect statement, Bob,
but
actually,
I take
it.
Let
Tony get it. Go ahead, Tony.
Regarding Israeli domestic politics, of which I know even less than I do about New York state politics, nonetheless, it strikes me there's a certain possible danger here, which is that if the Likud party splits, that might be the case, and assuming that a majority party combined with Labor and the left rump of Likud, if you will, that the danger could be that all of the passion regarding the settlers would be outside of the governing party. I think it's healthy for it to be inside the governing party and managed. If it's outside, it becomes more and more alienated and potentially violent.
I actually want to go back to what Matt said, because there is a distinction in terms of the seriousness that was experienced in this country briefly after 9/11, and which is the seriousness that is experienced in Israel all the time. We lost that sense of sort of being in the presence of life and death decisions every day, which we had briefly after 9/11, partly because our own leaders did not appeal to it. They did not call on us to do anything beyond going shopping. They did not call on us to sacrifice. They therefore lost that moment, and we certainly have not recaptured it.
And there is something, Bob, acknowledging all your points. Maybe it's something about the universality of the sacrifice or the stakes that are sort of universal, which, you know, as we've talked about before, there's so few people who actually have a tangible stake in being over there themselves, having family that's over there in Iraq. But I don't mean to poo-poo,
which
obviously, all the
Cindy
seriousness.
Sheehan.
But let's talk about Iraq. It's a good segue. Obviously, Iraq missed its constitutional deadline. You know, some people would say, well, I think it took our founders about 13 years, right, to get from 1776 to 1789. It's not easy to do. So what happened? We gave them another week. There was a very funny riff on Jon Stewart about, okay, you've missed your deadline. Did you guys see this? We'll give you an extra week. But hear this. The best grade you can get is a B. Tony, it's more serious than that, I'm sure. But what do you make of where this stands?
I'd be happy with a B. Look, I think while there are a lot of issues in the constitutional debate, I think the central one that may or may not be unresolvable is the question of how federated it's going to be. The Sunnis do not want too much federation. The Kurds and the Shias would be happy with it. The Kurds and the Shias can overrule the Sunnis in the vote in the provisional, but if that's the case, then they have not brought the Sunnis in to governance, and the Sunnis presumably are the key to reducing the insurgency. So this is a very difficult problem on fundamental principles having to do with oil wealth and semi-sovereignty, and I'll be interested to see whether they can resolve it. That would be hard for any people to resolve, and for these folks under these conditions, very hard.
Well, the other major issue is, of course, is this going to be a budding theocracy, or is it going to really be a democracy, and what is going to be the role of the Islamic religion in the constitution, and as a result, what is going to be the role of women, what are going to be the rights of women. I mean, there are so, so many issues. And the expectation, as John Stewart so amusingly illustrated, that all these issues are going to be resolved if you give them another week. It's just so preposterous. And you're wondering how much of this is being driven by American political realities and the need for George Bush to do something to save his plummeting approval ratings.
How about, Bob, I mean, how important is a constitution at this point for them?
Well, I think the analogy you made with the founders gets at why it is important. And first of all, it's deeply insulting to our founders. They would not have allowed the English crown to supervise their activity, to set deadlines. In fact, they would not have allowed the English crown to pick who our founders would be. The whole point of a revolution was to get rid of the foreigner, not to welcome him in.
But they would have loved Chalabi as the Iron Minister.
Yes. Well, so the main
the
thing
analogy is, really would
is,
be
is it Japan.
The analogy really in that would be France, where they would listen to the French after the French helped the colonists drive the English out. I think would be the
fair. Well, but that's
analogy.
Not what happened here. The fact is, the people didn't make their own history. The fact is that the United States, and we're not going to revisit it, as you always point out, under totally false pretenses.
But Japan didn't either, right?
Let me just say, the issue here is that the Constitution is an attempt at this point to provide the essential framework. It's not a papering over, because these separate parties are not going to go along unless that Constitution enshrines a principle of federalism that the Kurds can live with, that the Shiites want. It also begs the question, as Ariana points out, of the role of religion, which, you know, and what it really goes to, and then the fact that you have oil here. And if you don't have a settlement of some kind of share that everyone accepts, you have a prescription for war without end. And that what is really involved is the absurdity of the neoconservative vision that they were just going to go in, get rid of this dictator, and boom, paradise was going to unfold. In fact, you've got a situation that may go on for another 50 years because, as I say, any of these solutions, imposing one religious view, imposing one notion of federalism, is going to be an invitation to the other parties to engage in continuing insurgency. And so the end is by no means in sight. The important lesson to learn here is that we should get out of the picture, because we are part of the problem. We help create the problem. We are not part of the solution.
Tommy?
Well, I mean, in fairness, we are the reason why there's any possibility of a solution. And our guidance of them, pushing them to try to make a decision, is helping them focus at least. Now, maybe they won't be able to reach a conclusion, and I concede that. But the idea that they'd be this close, that they would have had an election, that they would have selected a leadership and is now seriously negotiating between the different tribes and religions on a constitution, is a tremendous, I think, accomplishment of the American intervention. Whether it's sufficient remains to be seen. I just want to go briefly to the question of a theocracy versus a democracy. I suspect that if we get something, it'll be somewhere between the Israeli governance, which is a Jewish state and nonetheless democratic. It has elements of Jewish theology in it regarding citizenship and parentage and that sort of thing. On the other hand, it's nowhere near the Iranian theocracy. I suspect what we'll get out of any Muslim country trying to form a democracy is something somewhere to the theocratic side of the Israeli form of government, when one hopes not too far.
Up ahead, the Cindy Sheehan circus and crusade continues. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller in the center. Robert Scheer is in San Francisco on the left, Tony Blankley in Washington on the right, and Ariana Huffington with me in Santa Monica and also somewhere beyond politically. The Cindy Sheehan issue has continued to dominate a lot of the news, the continued unwillingness of the president to engage with her. different attacks from the right on her motives and agenda, also growing legions of anti-war supporters, finding her a important rallying point in this. Ariana, I know you've been watching this closely. What's this week in Cindy Sheehan? What's the report?
Well, actually, Gary Hart did a very interesting blog on the Huffington Post about how she's part of the very rich American history of protest. I mean, she going back to the abolitionists and the suffragettes and the civil rights marchers. I mean, that's the tradition that Cindy Sheehan is part of. And what is interesting, given that, is the way that the mainstream media, forgetting for a minute the way the right-wing media have tried to eviscerate her. And I don't mean just Rush Limbaugh. And I don't mean just Bill O'Reilly calling her treasonous. And I don't mean just Michelle Malkin, but even people on Fox that you normally would expect to show a little more restraint, like Charles Krauthammer, have really gone after her. But the mainstream media have treated her with a level of condescension that is kind of staggering on the cable shows, not so much in print. You have that kind of Andrea Mitchell slight sort of wry smile, like, I know we have to cover her, but do we really need to cover her? And really avoiding to deal with the fact that this is a woman who's lost her son in a war she doesn't believe in, and she wants to ask the president, what is that noble purpose that he claims her son died for? So immediately Andrea Mitchell moved on to ask Joe Biden, do you agree with her proposal to withdraw troops? So this is obviously not the fundamental thing that Cindy Sheehan represents. She's not a foreign policy expert. She is a grieving mother. And a lot of the mainstream media don't want to deal with what she represents, especially at a time of growing disenchantment with this war, and over 60% of Americans believing it was a mistake.
Now, Tony, I noticed this week that the Wall Street Journal, predictably, perhaps smartly, found room on its op-ed page for a parent of a lost Iraqi soldier who is a war supporter to begin to try and show that there are others and give them a voice as well. What do you make of where things stand?
Well, I'm amused that Ariana is noticing this sly condescension on the face of the mainstream media, because, of course, that force has been targeted against conservatives for generations now, and it is obnoxious to be the recipient of that. I share her sentiment in that regard. As I said last week,
this is really sensitivity training for the left, then.
Yes. I'm not going to comment on a Gold Star mother's comments and feelings. The media, obviously, I think, is overplaying it. The Wall Street Journal is attempting to give some balance. I don't think they will succeed. This is turning into a very wonderful August story, and it will probably effervesce eventually.
Bob?
Yeah, I don't think the media is overplaying it at all. What they did was underplay the human cost of this war. And the reason they could get away with it, and the reason maybe many people in the media felt this way, is their connection with the war, with the exception of some very brave journalists who were not embedded and who go out on the streets. This was a war that was presented by Paul Wolfowitz and others as a war without cost. It's a war that was not supposed to hit us in the pocketbook, and it's a war that's not supposed to cause the loss of life of anybody who matters. And what Cindy Sheehan is saying is it cost the life of somebody that mattered a great deal to me. And I have not heard from this president why that war was fought and why it must continue. And this is what democracy with a small d is supposed to be all about. These issues are not subject, you know, grist for the windbags on television. This is not a game we're playing. But the president of the United States made decisions to put people in harm's way. You can defend it or attack it. And here's a woman who's exercising her basic right to say, why did you do this to my son? I'm holding you accountable. I don't understand where democracy functions any better than a moment like that.
Well, there is actually something else that's been going on that is fascinating, and this is the double standard when it comes to how much every single thing this woman has ever said over the last year has been scrutinized compared to the kind of scrutiny that is being given by the mainstream media to the most ludicrous statements made by the president, senior members of his administration, people who have the ability to make life and death decisions. They can say things like Dick Cheney saying the insurgency is in its last throes. Condoleezza Rice can say in the lead up to the war there is going to be an impending mushroom cloud in Iraq if we don't invade. And these statements are not scrutinized every day as they should be until the reputation of the people who have made them is in tatters. But that kind of scrutiny is given to everything that Cindy Sheehan has ever said. It's just really amusing, really.
I don't know. Can we really say there hasn't been? I mean, there was the 18 words that Bush uttered famously in the State of the Union that probably preoccupied three months of 16 words.
16
words. Sorry, you know,
maybe two others.
That sentence gets
two
longer.
Two others that are too discreet to even be commented on. I'd like to ask Robert a question, and it's more intonation in what he said. When he used the word "embedded" regarding reporters, it sounded like he was suggesting they had lost their virtue by being embedded. Did he not approve of that method of journalism? I'm just curious.
They didn't lose their virtue. They lost their freedom. That's the issue here. I'm not talking about their decency or anything else. I'm saying when you allow your government to be the main way that you can get the news is by being embedded in its military machine, you're not able to cover what's going on. And as I mentioned before, going into Gaza and being in Egypt at the end of the Six-Day War, and I've been in war zones. I was in Vietnam and other places trying to get the news. The last thing you want to do is be part of the military machine trying to get that news. And yes, I would say, and if you want to bring up the Judy Miller case would be a perfect example, where there's an embedded journalist that we're supposed to be rallying around now, according to the leaders of the New York Times, who disgracefully disgraced the profession by presenting lies from emigres and from the government under the protection of embeddedment and even tried to manipulate the troops that were supposed to be protecting us. So yes, I would say the whole embedded experience, and I think Tim Robbins' play, which is now on Sundance Channel, captures that. It was a sad day for American journalism.
What's the play?
It's called Embedded.
Got it.
And it's on Sundance Channel.
It'll be on Sundance on Sunday, I'm told.
Yes.
If you're looking for something to watch on Sunday when this airs,
highly recommended. And moving on to Judy Miller, it is really fascinating how the New York Times this week moved into major preemptive Judy Miller PR. They had a glowing editorial continuing their effort to present her as a First Amendment martyr. Then they had Bob Dole penning an op-ed, again defending her. And Floyd Abrams, one of her lawyers, was dispatched on Lou Dobbs to defend her. So you wonder, what are they expecting? Because there is the possibility of criminal contempt charges against her. The story is turning reporters within the New York Times into two camps: those who believe that the paper is dragging the institution down with them, meaning Sulzberger, especially the publisher of the paper, determined to support and stand by Judy Miller without asking the tough questions, like was she assigned to do a story, was she having communications with Libby and Rove, where maybe she was giving information as much as getting information from them? And what exactly was her role in all this?
Well, I've got to confess that watching liberals rip into the New York Times is... I don't want to intervene, so I'll just enjoy the fight.
And to be feeling the sensitivity of liberal media condescension, right? It's like a whole re-education plan.
Yeah, this is a whole smorgasbord of quiet delights.
Bob, we've still got a couple of minutes before we rant. Where do you want to take it?
Well, I'm sorry to pile on with the New York Times, but don't forget there's some history of this. And it goes to the whole question of secret sources. You can call the New York Times or any mainstream paper liberal if you like, but their liberalism did not stop them from smearing Wenho Lee. And the man spent 9 months in solitary. Basically, the charges were dropped, all but one very minor charge. And that whole case would have gone nowhere if not for the New York Times' dependence on secret sources, which turned out to be government sources. And I think the accountability around Judy Miller, and was this an attempt, was she part of an attempt to destroy former Ambassador Wilson's telling us the truth about weapons of mass destruction? Was she protecting her own turf and the distorted position that she'd presented? So I think they're real issues.
Would you make the same argument against Seymour Hersh, who also gets government sources to give him secret information about government policy, particularly in foreign policy? If he were called in, would you say that he ought to give up his sources?
I would say that the protection of sources should stop at the point, and I believe this is the policy now of most papers, that if you've been misinformed by a government source or by any source, and that misinformation has been passed on to your readers, then you lose the confidentiality and you have an obligation to expose that.
So if Seymour If he
has been deceived by a government source, yes, then that source loses the right of confidentiality. I think that's generally recognized. If it isn't, it ought to be, because our main obligation as journalists is to our readers, not to our sources. And as long as they are true whistleblowers, as long as they are exposing wrongdoing and so forth, then you can make the case for confidentiality. But when you are being manipulated by the government or any other powerful person, where they have lied to you and you keep that lie and you don't say where this came from, then you're protecting their manipulation of the citizens.
Yep. Well, and actually, Bill Kovac, who was the former New York Times bureau chief in Washington, has said in relation to Judy Miller that that also was New York Times policy, that you had no reason or obligation to protect an anonymous source if that source had in fact misled and lied to you.
We have reached that time once again for our famed end of show, Left, Right, and Center Rant, featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. Tony Blankley, it is your soapbox.
Ohio Governor Robert Taft, holder of one of the great names in the Republican Party, pleaded guilty in a misdemeanor ethics violation for playing golf on various interest groups' dime, or in this case, thousands of dollars. I would wish, as a fellow golfer, that they would pay for their own darn rounds of golf. It's not that expensive. I can't believe how many politicians have to take money from people just to play golf.
Bob Scheer, about 20 seconds.
Yeah, 3 years ago, the Bush administration put this policy of punishing countries that refuse to give up their right to have an international standard on genocide and use the permanent tribunal of the Hague on this. And there are 12 countries in Latin America that are being penalized by the U.S. government because they will not forego their right to condemn genocide on an international basis. So after decades of lecturing Latin America about the importance of human rights, we're now going to punish them for taking human rights seriously. This is an abomination on the part of the Bush administration.
Arianna Huffington.
This is a week that showed us once again how much symbols matter. And the fact that Cindy Sheehan was in Crawford at the very moment when the president was going on bike rides and fundraisers and not having time to meet with her made that contrast between the two of them and what they each represented much starker.
Well, interesting news from New York this week. William Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts, who's been living in New York for some years and was born and raised there, announced that he's throwing his hat in the ring to run against Eliot Spitzer, the Democrat, the current attorney general, for governor in 2006. This is going to make what looked like a cakewalk for Eliot Spitzer into one of the most important nationally watched battles for governor, especially given Weld's more liberal kind of Rockefeller Republican profile, and it's going to make it the race, one of the races to watch next year. Also, I owe listeners an apology for some bawdy limericks I read from the Washington Post on air last week. When someone first sent them from the Washington Post style section invitational contest, I thought they were funny and worth sharing with you. I did not stop to think that some listeners might rightly object to the images they conjured. For those who were offended by them, please know I'm sorry. In the future, I'll strive always to deliver the clean, family-friendly punditry you've come to expect from Left, Right, and Center. That's all we have time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks always to my co-hosts, Bob Scheer, Arianna Huffington, and Tony Blankley. Sarah Spitz produced today's program. Our technical director is Ray Guarner, with a big assist from David Green. Thanks also to WAMU in Washington, D.C., and Sports Byline in San Francisco. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in again for more Left, Right, and Center.
I wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
But we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of
all. Audio archives and podcasts of KCRW programs are at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about Left, Right, and Center, email lrc@kcrw.com. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by 89.9 KCRW Santa Monica and kcrw.com.